I love to laugh loud and long and clear. I love to laugh.
So do you love to laugh? Why do we laugh anyway? We'll find out this hour and hopefully have some laughs along the way. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. What was the last thing you laughed at? I laughed at the funniest joke in the world that I read this morning. And we will share with you what the funniest joke in the world is. And we will also welcome the situations and the types of jokes that you find funny. What makes you LOL? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest, Scott Weems, a cognitive neuroscientist. He is the author of Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So why did you decide to explore the subject of laughter?
Well, it's a fun topic. I don't know why everybody doesn't want to study it. When I was in graduate school, I didn't know that you could make a living studying laughter. It's not one of the big topics that most people in my field study, which are things like language and memory. But the more I immersed myself in these other topics, the more I learned that humor is on par with intelligence and language and these other things that really are the higher cognitive functions. It's a very human trait, humor is. And so I think the more we understand humor, the more we can understand pretty much all aspects of our complex thinking.
It is fascinating. What do we know, basically, so far about how our brains process humor? What's going on in our noggin as we laugh at a joke?
I think really it all comes down to, it really all comes down to humor is how we deal with conflict in our lives, conflict, ambiguity, all these things that just kind of surprise us or put us on edge that we're not sure how to deal with. And we've had to come up with a way to respond to these events. Sometimes that's in the form of a punchline. Sometimes it's just some very strange circumstance in our life that we don't know how to deal with, and we just naturally laugh, which is why we laugh when we meet with strangers for the first time. We laugh during uncomfortable silences. And there's particular parts of the brain that have become specialized for dealing with this, and that's why, really, I think humor is just a coping mechanism more than anything.
Is there a funny bone in the brain?
There is, and without getting too technical, it's called the anterior cingulate. It's not on the surface. It's just below the surface, and it's essentially our conflict detector. So it's active. It's active for lots of different things, but it's active when you process a joke. It's active also during just moments of surprise. And so really, I think what's happening when we get a joke or just whenever we laugh, we're processing these kind of surreal moments. And our anterior cingulate is getting very active, and it's telling us, you know, we need to work this out. And sometimes that makes us laugh because it leads to a fun conclusion.
How come some people would groan and other people, you know, laugh so hard they cry to the same joke or same situation?
Yeah, it's funny how humor is very idiosyncratic. I mean, we all have different thresholds for what we find funny versus offensive, or what we find just engaging, or what we find boring. I personally love just absurd humor, just kind of jokes that, how many surrealists does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
Fish. It's just strange, right? And I should say I'm a scientist. I'm not trained to tell jokes. I tell them terribly, but these are the kind of things I like, and these are the kind of moments when I think some of us, in fact, there's personality tests that show that some people, we call them sensation seekers, their brains get very active when they process these kind of jokes. They enjoy the work of going through and trying to figure out what does that joke mean. Some people's brains get more quiet, and I think that's why there's such differences. It's really linked with personality. Are we the kind of person that really likes engaging our brains and getting them active and trying to figure things out? Or does a joke like that just kind of leave us wanting? And
yeah,
that would be a more quiet brain.
Well, let's talk about what made that joke funny. I found that your joke funny.
Oh, thank you. Okay. You might be the minority, but thank you.
Yeah. But what was it that made that funny?
Well, it really all comes down to building an expectation. You start to form a mental image of what the joke is about, and then suddenly that turns. So there's the old quote by Groucho Marx, I think, where he says, "Yesterday I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How it got in my pajamas, I have no idea." And these kind of jokes you don't see too much anymore. Well, you do. Actually, there's Stephen Colbert made a version of it during the 2008 elections when he said, "If I'm reading this polling data correctly, I'd be very surprised." So, you know, to take the...
Because he's reading it correctly.
Because he's reading it correctly. Yeah. You know, it's kind of his alter personality. So to the Groucho Marx line, I mean, the first half of the sentence, you're thinking Groucho Marx is in the pajamas. But then suddenly, halfway through, your brain tries to imagine an elephant in pajamas, which is a little ridiculous and completely different than what you started off expecting. And so I think our brains enjoy that sudden turn. They enjoy the exercise of reshifting their way of thinking. In this case, thinking of an elephant in pajamas.
Well, I do want to, before too long, reveal the funniest joke in the world, which you wrote about recently. But let's talk a little bit about how do scientists research laughter? How do you figure this out?
It's tough sometimes, right? Because just telling people you're watching them will be tricky. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll change their behavior. One of my favorite studies by a man named Robert Provine, a psychologist in Maryland, he just went out and eavesdropped on people, like thousands of people he listened in to and his assistants in coffee shops and subways and wherever he can find them, and just measured how often they laughed, and then also recorded things about them. So were they male or female? What was the circumstance? And so that's one way. And he found that women laugh much more than men, which
really?
Was interesting. You put two women together, you know, in a coffee shop, wherever, they're, I think they'll laugh twice as much as two men.
Is that, what, do we know why?
Well, that's really tough to guess, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
There have been some studies that show slight differences in brain activation for men and women when processing jokes. Women actually, their brains are pretty active, even if the joke isn't very satisfying. Men's brains will get kind of quiet if it's a bad joke. And it might be that women put more effort into the humor, so they're more a little more open-minded, a little more willing to do the work for processing a joke. There's evolutionary theories, too. There's the theory that humor is really a good sign of genetic fitness. We look for a sense of humor in a partner. And so, I mean, for women, it's the number one thing that they look for in relationships. For men, it's sometimes a little bit lower because intelligence and good looks will sometimes be higher. And so one theory is that women especially look for humor in their mate because it shows a man with an active brain, someone who's not only just a good thinker and processor, but one who is generally nurturing and social too. And there have been links for that as well.
Talk a little bit about the research that was done by... Wiseman, and when he was trying to find the funniest joke in the world.
Yes, the funniest joke in the world. This is science, so it must be the funniest
mm-hmm.
joke. He just conducted a huge study. I think millions of people rated different jokes, and he did it through a website, so he was able to get people from all over the world to not only submit their favorite jokes, but then rate ones other people had submitted. So it was just a huge experiment, and from that he got tons of data. So he found some things just odd, like if you have jokes with different kinds of talking animals, he was able to manipulate which animals did the talking, and he found that the ducks are the funniest animal.
Yeah, we think ducks are funny, okay.
Ducks are funny. So if you have a choice of telling a joke with a talking cow or a talking duck, choose the duck.
We want the duck, yeah. So that's why they picked a duck for Aflac, maybe.
Yeah, it's funny. The hard consonants are funny, I guess. But then he also found what was the funniest joke in the world, and he was somewhat relieved that it won because there were some close ones that he didn't like. The most submitted example was "What's brown and sticky?"
What is that?
A stick.
That's not very funny.
No, hundreds of people said that is so much so that his research assistant started complaining. They just got that joke so many times they got sick of it.
brown and sticky, and it's a stick. That sounds like a kindergartner would use that as a joke.
I don't know. Maybe it's got some universal appeal or something. A lot of people sent that in.
Well, without further ado, as you wrote in a Huffington Post piece, do you have it memorized, or should I share the scientifically proven funniest joke in the world?
Oh, I've got it memorized, but you're more than welcome to tell it just to mix things up. It's up to you.
All right. Two hunters are out in the woods when one of them collapses. He's not breathing and his eyes are glazed, so his friend calls 911. My friend is dead. What should I do? The operator replies, "Calm down, sir. I can help. First, make sure that he's dead." There's a silence, and then there's a loud bang. Back on the phone, the guy says, "Okay, now what?" So why is that funny?
Yeah, that's, well, I mean, I guess you're coming back to that expectation. You don't expect the guy to want to kill his friend, and then he does that. It's also a little edgy, too, right?
Yeah,
I mean, we laugh at murder far more often than you would think we should, and that's common. And so I think people also like their edge, and there's science behind that, too, that people like their jokes to be a little bit, offensive isn't the best word, but just engaging in a somewhat edgy way, but not too much. Too much, and we know how we feel pretty straightforward. It's just, you know, off-putting. But there's a kind of a sweet spot, and I think that joke is pretty close to the sweet spot.
It is. It's pretty good. Well, let's take a short break. Let's ask listeners if you have questions for our guest, Scott Weems, a cognitive neuroscientist, author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. What makes you laugh? Do you prefer certain kinds of jokes? Have you ever been in a situation where you started laughing but didn't really know why? Not all laughter has to do with a joke. Sometimes we laugh at inappropriate times, and we'll find out why we do that in just a few minutes, and we'll take your questions and your stories at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Juggles the Clown brought pleasure to millions. The characters he created will be remembered by children and adults alike. Peter Peanut. Mr. Fee-Fi-Fo. Billy Banana. And my particular favorite, Aunt Yoo-Hoo. And not just for the laughter that they provided. There was always some deeper meaning to whatever Chuckles did.
Do you remember that classic scene from the Mary Tyler Moore Show when Mary was laughing during the funeral of Chuckles the Clown? Why do we sometimes laugh at solemn occasions, inappropriate times? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking with Scott Weems. He is the author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. And so, Scott, why do people sometimes laugh at funerals? And in fact, didn't you laugh at a funeral once in your lifetime?
I did, and it was one of the reasons I wanted to write the book, actually, is I was worried if there was something wrong with me. And that old Mary Tyler Moore bit about Chuckles the Clown funeral, that's just a classic. It's funny how many people connected with that. I hope everybody's had the chance to see it. It's common, right, where we laugh at times when we don't think we should. And it really gets back to, I think, the idea that humor is so much more than just stand-up comedy. We often think of humor as just defined by the kind of jokes like, you know, we've been sharing here and there. But it's really much more of a coping mechanism when it's just when we have no other way to respond. So sometimes during a funeral, if we feel the moment is both serious and yet we remember the positive things about the person who has passed away, these are some very conflicting emotions. We very seldom have straightforward emotional response. In fact, there's a name for it. Again, without getting too technical, it's called cathexis. Mm-hmm. Freud talked about catharsis, which is the cleansing of emotions. But there's an opposite of that, too. It's called cathexis, and it's when we have multiple emotions at once. It's a rich emotional experience. these are the moments, I think, when we're most alive, because we're having such rich emotional feelings, and I think that's also when we really are closest to humor.
So is there something to that old phrase, you laugh so you don't cry, you know, that it is somewhat of a coping mechanism?
It is, and sometimes we both laugh and cry at the same time. This is not unusual. I mean, I'm thinking another funeral story, but when Graham Chapman died, the members of Monty Python, they started, it's another one I just absolutely love, they started singing, "Let's look at the, always look at the bright side of life."
Yes.
It's kind of hard not to sing that, you know, in your head when you hear it, but, you know, they sang and they told, you know, body jokes about their old friend, and these are the kind of moments when we're really, these are complex emotional times when I think that's the easiest way to respond, is we let these emotions out, both the positive and the sad.
Was it your wife who laughed at the closing scene of the Titanic?
Yes. I brought that up, and I included that in the book, and I brought it up in a couple of interviews, and I think she's not happy with me for sharing it.
But it was because it was kind of schmaltzy or odd or I don't what?
Yeah, she's not one for sentimental movies. It was my parents' choice of movie. Not that Titanic's not a great movie, mm-hmm. but it was the end of Titanic, and Leonardo DiCaprio is drowning. And she's not one to connect necessarily with the sentimentality of that scene. And so she's just laughing. And of course, everybody in the theater is crying. And she just laughs even more. And then she whispers in my ear, "Yo, Adrian." You know, I think we're calling to like Rocky III when he's out in the snow in Siberia training and he yells to his wife. And it's so grossly inappropriate. But I couldn't help but laugh following that, too, just.
And then you got kicked out of the theater.
No. We didn't get kicked out. My mother-in-law was there, and she was not happy with her very new daughter-in-law. So it was all sorts of social awkwardness with that. But, I mean, if you think about the way James Cameron handled that climax, it was like the emotional equivalent of his Terminator 2 or Aliens, where, you know, he's just pounding you over the head with emotion trying to. And sometimes we rebel. I think our heads rebel. We see that in all sorts of internet jokes following tragedies, too. We like to rebel when we feel like people are trying to manipulate our emotions.
Yeah. Brings to mind the black humor. But I was thinking of how I sometimes am genuinely laughing at something that I think is very, very funny, and I will laugh so hard that I start crying. What's going on there?
Well, laughter is a violent activity. I mean, we think of it as light, and sometimes we just have a chuckle. But if you laugh hard, it's actually been shown. I think it's pretty close to the same calories burned as jogging. So, I mean, I don't think you could laugh for an hour straight like we do for jogging and get the same kind of exercise, but it's a vigorous exercise. And so I think, yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard not to cry if you're really putting your body through that. And there have been times, this is a slight tangent, but there was a laughter epidemic where in Central Africa where girls were overcome by laughter and it became contagious and it lasted for over a year. And they started almost having nervous breakdowns because the laughter was just, it was so violent, they kind of lost control.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I don't want to laugh that much, but I could see laughing a little bit more if it's like vigorous exercise.
It's good for you.
We'll talk a little bit about, health benefits of or what we know of, about the science of the health benefits of laughter coming up in just a bit. But we do have some callers, and we have a line for you, too, if you have a question about the science of laughter, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We are talking with Scott Weems. He's the author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. And our first caller is Jim in Wanakee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I wonder if your guest could speak to a couple historical figures, Viktor Frankl in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, used laughter in terms of dealing with these horrible, dire circumstances, facing death at any time, and they'd have dark humor about touching the electric fence that surrounded the death camps. And the other figure is Norman Cousins, and he had a terminal illness, and he was told this by the doctors, and they had told him that there wasn't much more they could do. So he said, "Well, if I'm going to die, I'm going to enjoy myself before I go." And he brought in all these W.C. Fields movies, and he got so wild with his laughter that they had to ask him to leave the hospital. So he checked into a motel, but he kept laughing and laughing and worked his way to recovery. And I know there's been a lot of research in terms of chronic pain patients in terms of using laughter as a therapeutic approach.
Thank you very much, Jim. I was going to bring up these health issues a little bit later, but you brought them up now, so that's great. Scott?
Yeah, Jim, I think you're right on both of the examples you give as far as really sheds a lot of light on humor. The first, to talk about Viktor Frankl real quick, and I guess sometimes it's called gallows humor.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we do laugh a lot of times at very dark circumstances, and I do explore this. And I like the term, actually somebody used the term to describe Kurt Vonnegut's writing as rapid truthing. And said, because Kurt Vonnegut definitely uses humor, and a lot of it's quite dark. I mean, he writes about Dresden in Slaughterhouse-Five. And so I think it's because that's what we're doing when we make a joke about these very serious matters, is we're getting at the truth faster than we are accustomed. And so that's why you see a lot of humor in places like doctor's offices or during times of war when, I mean, it's sometimes there's nothing else to do but laugh, but sometimes we're laughing because we're addressing these topics straight on. We're talking about death, which is a very serious topic. But you're also recognizing we're kind of gaining power over it, I guess, by talking about death and joking about it. So it's a way of getting power again. And I guess getting power again brings us to Norman Cousins, mm-hmm. too, which is another great example. He, you're exactly right. I think it was, I always butcher the name. I'm not a medical doctor, but I think ankylosing spondylosis or something like that. It's a collagen disease that he had. And he did. He just got sick of the medical treatments they were giving him. So he checked in a hotel and then just laughed and made sure to keep laughing for hours a day. And even though they said he would die very soon, he wound up living dozens of more years and basically almost fully recovered from this very terrible disease. And he attributed laughing as a major cause of it.
Yeah,
wrote a great book about it, too, Anatomy of an Illness. So it was fantastic.
And do we know from science if laughter is indeed the best medicine?
It is. Well, the best, I don't know. I would say laughter and a good dose of penicillin is always
good. Right.
So, yes, absolutely, laughter helps. There are things in our blood called natural killer cells. They're kind of an immunatory response where they attack cancer and viruses and things like that. We know that these natural killer cells increase following laughter and humor. So we can basically boost our immune system response simply by enjoying comedy. We know that comedy improves pain tolerance, lowers anxiety, and improves heart health. So the number of, and then there's some really odd stuff that I'm not sure we understand the mechanisms for, but it improves symptoms of dermatitis and helps insulin rebound for diabetics. I mean, there's almost too many health benefits to count. Some of them understood and some of them not so well. So I definitely say it's a good thing.
Let's play a clip of Bill Cosby saying something funny, I presume, and then talk about what you write about in the book at the Bill Cosby effect. Let's take a listen.
The man ate dirt till he was 30 years old. That's all it was dirt. And he was thankful to eat that dirt. That's the part I couldn't understand. No matter how much he suffered, he'd always say, and I was thankful to get it. My father walked to school 4 o'clock every morning, with no shoes on, uphill, both ways, in 5 feet of snow, and he was thankful.
I guess we all had the same dad, didn't we? That was Bill Cosby talking about his dad. So what is the Bill Cosby effect?
Yeah, I love this. Simply watching stand-up or watching comedy or listening to a bit like we just heard, that's enough to get the health benefits we were just talking about. So I call it the Bill Cosby effect because there's one particular study that had people listen to Bill Cosby like we just did. and then measure their tolerance for pain. And you can do that in a couple different ways. One, you can actually do it by measuring, by giving people drugs after treatment for surgery. Like, so one doctor actually monitored people after their surgery and measured how much drugs they required to combat their pain. Or you can do it experimentally by, for example, putting people's hands in very cold water, just above freezing, but enough that they won't get frostbite, but still cold enough that it hurts, and see how long they can keep their hand in that cold water. And both kinds of experiments have shown that simply listening to Bill Cosby or Robin Williams or a number of other comedians is enough to increase your tolerance of pain and improve your recovery time.
Well, let's take some other callers. Pete in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Pete.
Well, hello. How are you doing today? Hey, I had just a comment and just to bounce an idea off you. I was able to spend some time in Germany some years ago and shared as many different jokes as I could in English, translated into German, just to see what people would laugh at. And I was just astounded that some things that we wouldn't think is that funny at all, they would laugh hysterically over, and things that I thought were just gutbuster hilarious, they would look at me and say, "Why is that funny?" Maybe your guest would like to speak to that a little bit, and I'll take my comments off here.
Thank you, Pete. Great question, and you do know a little bit. We have a different sense of humor in depending on where we live, Scott?
We do. Excuse me. Yes, Pete, you're right. It's funny how American tastes in humor are a little specialized. We like aggressive jokes more so than other parts of the world. So there's the joke of a Texan talking to a Harvard graduate, and the Texan asks, "Where are you from?" And the Harvard graduate says, "I come from a place where we don't end our sentences in prepositions." And the Texan says, "Okay, where are you from, jackass?" So, again, I probably don't deliver that as well, and hopefully I'm allowed to say that on the air.
Yes.
Okay, so that's a very American joke. It's confrontational and just, you know, a little bit aggressive, not bad. British tastes, and I guess European tastes in general, they like the absurd kind of humor. Surreal, odd. So another example is a dog walks in a telegraph office, and he says he wants to send a message. And so the operator says, "Okay, what's your message?" And the dog says, "It's woof, 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 woof." And the operator says, "You know, that's only 9. You can send a 10th woof for free." And the dog says, "But that would make no sense." That is a British joke all the way. So, and in fact, in Wiseman's study where they were looking at the funniest joke in the world, both of those jokes I just gave were examples of American or British taste, respectively, and didn't do as well in the other locations.
Why do some of us laugh? And I'm gonna plead guilty when you see somebody slip on a banana peel. All of a sudden you start laughing. You know, you don't want, somebody might have hurt themselves, yet we're busting a gut, as our caller said. What's going on there?
Yeah, slapstick is an unusual kind of comedy, isn't it? And I think it really comes down to, again, we're talking about that mixed messages. Mm-hmm. If I were to go after this interview and get in my car and hit somebody with my car, that wouldn't be funny to anybody.
No.
That would be a felony. But if I go home and I watch Johnny Knoxville on television put on a chicken suit, have somebody hit him with a car, I might laugh. And I think that's because I will understand in that second example that the intention isn't to maim or to hurt. I mean, there's Three Stooges is a great example. The guys never suffer injuries. They're never, you know, actually physically hurt. They just get poked in the eye and things. And I think you need to have that balance of, okay, yes, this is a very violent activity, but the intention is not to hurt. And you see this in all kinds of comedy. Anytime you forget that there needs to be that caring aspect of it behind the violent humor, be it emotional or physical, you know, aggressiveness, then it doesn't connect as well. You need to have both.
Yeah, I just saw a real life example of a weather reporter, a well-known weather reporter, was doing a live stand-up on television, a stand-up, you know, standing in front of some weather element, and some drunk kid ran into the frame, and the weather reporter kneed him in the crotch, and that guy ran off. And so this was, somebody did get hurt, but people thought it was hilarious. And I have to admit, I was like, hey, bravo to the weather reporter. And it was funny to watch it. You know, somebody did get hurt, really, in that situation. So is there some sort of justice going on here that made us laugh at that?
Well, something tells me it wouldn't have been funny if she just walked up to somebody randomly and kneed them.
Right.
But something tells me that if you're... Did you say he was naked?
No, he wasn't.
Oh, he was. Okay, I'm sorry. I thought... Maybe
he could have been. No, but he wasn't.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. Regardless, if there's somebody who just disrupts a TV show and just kind of runs in and acts crazy, I think you're making an implicit agreement that you're participating in whatever follows, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the same thing if somebody just runs onto a football or baseball pitch, you know, just to, you know, be the spectacle of in front of the whole crowd. I think you're kind of implicitly agreeing to whatever that follows, so I don't think people mind if you get tackled or hit. But if it just happens to somebody randomly, that wouldn't have been funny.
We are talking about laughter and what makes us laugh. We're talking about the science of when we laugh and why. What makes you laugh? Are there certain jokes or certain situations that you find hilarious or maybe the opposite? Have you ever been in a situation where you started laughing and you didn't really know why? What questions or what clean jokes do you have that you'd like to share? 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
You the manager?
Yes.
You know the guy's name?
I'm telling you their names.
Well, who's on first?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I'm asking you.
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you.
You ain't telling me nothing. I'm asking you who's on first.
That's it.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first base.
That's his name.
That's whose name?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for?
So, did you think that was funny? That classic Abbott and Costello, who's on first routine? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine talking with Scott Weems. He's a neuroscientist and he is the author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. I just thought of Abbott and Costello as sort of a classic comedy team. Can you tell us the science of what made that funny, Scott?
Oh, my. I've actually never tried to dissect that one before. That's an interesting one. I mean, it is kind of fun that we are in on it. You know, we understand where the miscommunication is from, that there's baseball players with very strange names of pronouns. But I'm thinking that's probably where most of the humor is. It's just we're kind of in on it. They aren't. And there's a weird mix of knowledge and just frustration between the people. I don't know. I'd have to think about that one a little bit more. It's a classic, though, isn't it?
Let's go to Fred in Palmyra next. Hi, Fred.
Good morning. I was raised reading Mad Magazine, and I've always enjoyed satire. And I've been also told that my humor is very dry. And I do have a St. Patrick's Day joke, if you think we got time for it. It'll take me about a minute to tell it.
Yeah, all right. Well, I guess I feel like hearing a joke, as long as I don't have to bleep you, Fred.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay, what's your St. Patrick's Day joke?
Father Murphy was transferred to a parish in Texas, and he woke up one morning and looked out the window of his rectory and noticed it on the front lawn. There was a jackass dead on the front lawn. And so he called the local police department and said, "Good morning, and this is Father Murphy over at St. Mary's Parish." And he said, "I look out on my lawn this morning and there's a jackass dead on my front lawn." And the constable, who thought he was the resident wit, said that, "It's interesting, Father, but I always thought you people took care of the last rites." There was silence on the phone for a moment, and then Father Murphy said, "Aye, 'tis certainly true, sir, but we're also obliged to notify the next of kin."
Oh. All right. That was a good one, Fred. That was a good one, Scott.
It was. Yeah, it's kind of funny. There's a line by E.B. White who said,
dissecting humor is like dissecting frogs. The target always dies in the end. and so I think he was onto something. I love dissecting jokes, but some of them, maybe like the Who's on First, I kind of like to let them be a little bit, just because they're kind of there's a certain grace to that.
Yeah, I guess you want to talk a little bit about the definition of dry humor or satire.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on how straightforward you like your humor. And this is a very personal thing. Some of us like our humor a little absurd. Some of us like it straightforward. There's some interesting science, too, to show that our humor taste changes over time, too, and how old we are. I mean, dry humor is kind of what I enjoy. There's personality tests, and I like British humor, dry humor, that kind of thing. But we see that, in general, as people get older, they like more straightforward. It's called incongruity humor, which is the typical setup punchline, like the, how many people does it screw in a light bulb kind of jokes. We like that as we get older. As we're younger, we like absurd humor, maybe a little bit more dry, too. And it has to do with just expectations. I think when you're younger, you have you have fewer expectations. The world is still new, and you don't really have a mindset. As you get older, you like a little bit more structure, and we like that in our humor too. So, maybe I think this is such an emerging field now. We don't have it worked out yet, but one day I think we'll use humor to try and dissect personalities better too.
Bill from Cottage Grove emails: could you comment on the recent trend of laughing meetup groups?
Oh my! This is new for me. I'm guessing this is, from the name, this is just people who get together and laugh?
I'm guessing that, too. I know that there's been different, maybe even businesses will call someone in who can help people laugh, you know, and that kind of thing. So getting together just to laugh. Maybe we can just talk a little bit about how can we bring more humor into our lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think that idea of a laughter meetup group is great. And just anything that brings laughter in our lives is good. There've been, we talked about the health benefits a little bit already, that first we know that there's a lot of heart health and just immune system health from laughing. Laughing makes us smarter, too. Simply watching a comedy will help us improve insight and intelligence-based tasks, you know, like IQ kind of tests. So, If a workplace, or if we're doing this to kind of improve our lives, that's a good thing, as far as, you know, improving our cognitive fitness, I suppose. And so I could see how a laughing group would have some strong benefits. And the good news is it's merely an exposure issue. So we just have to watch the humor or listen to it to get the benefits. And so I think by surrounding ourselves with people who are laughing, laughter is contagious, then it's pretty much the first step in getting those benefits.
Betsy in Fitchburg. Hi, Betsy.
Hi.
That was good, Betsy. You could do that on cue. How did you do that?
I'm a laughter yoga leader.
What, tell us how you do this. What do you do?
Laughter yoga was started by Dr. Madan Kataria in India in 1995, and he was having a stressful time in his life. And read about Norman Cousins and others who found the benefits of laughter. So he has started the laughter yoga movement, which is almost a peace movement in the world. It's in over 70 countries with laughter yoga classes, laughter clubs, all of that. And it's not jokes and such per se. It's pure laughter. We actually create exercises to laugh. And the body doesn't know the difference between, like, listening to a joke or seeing a funny movie or just laughing. And it sees that you're laughing. It gets the chemical reactions. It makes you feel better. And it's just spiraling in the right direction of making you feel better.
Does that sound like fun? And then you do some yoga.
Well, the yoga part is actually breathing techniques.
Okay.
They're actually yoga breathing techniques because Dr. Kataria's wife was a yoga instructor, and she said, "You're laughing so hard, you need to take a deep breath." So the yoga part is purely deep breathing, basically, different breathing techniques.
Did you have any idea, Scott Weems?
I had heard of laughter yoga. I remember reading about that when I first started researching the book, but I hadn't heard much about it recently. I'm very happy to hear that it's going on, and this is locally for you that you do this?
Yep, there's a Madison Laughter Club. I also have, and I'll put my plug in, betterfunctioning.com. I'm also an occupational therapist, but I go around to different groups, group homes, schools, various settings, health fairs, and do laughter yoga.
I think that's great. We'll have to do a follow-up program sometime on these meetup groups and laughter yoga and these types of ways people are incorporating more laughter and why. So it's all for, it sounds like it's for stress relief and health benefits, Scott.
Yes, and I think it's a great idea, and I think you would get the benefits from that. Mm-hmm. If anything, it's good cardiovascular exercise. I mean, that's at the very minimum. The trick is finding a way to laugh for, you know, an hour straight. And I think that's a great way to do it. Incorporate it like in a yoga-style class would be fantastic.
You know, Ethan on Twitter says, some people's laughs make me laugh. Some people are self-conscious to laugh because people like Ethan laugh at them.
Laughter, we have said a couple times how contagious laughter is. And it truly is. I mean, when someone laughs, we are more likely to laugh too. And I think that's why comedies on, like, television have laugh tracks so frequently.
Mm-hmm.
We just are predisposed to laugh when people around us also laugh. But there's tricks to it too. And they've seen all sorts of experiments have tested this. And, I mean, we're more likely to laugh if the person next to us is a friend versus a stranger. The closer they are, the more people around us, the more we laugh. But everything goes out the window if we think the laughter is fake. So if we think somebody's trying to trick us into making us laugh or is laughing at something that they say is funny, but we really know that it's not, then we won't laugh. And I think that's why a lot of comedies now aren't including laugh tracks like they used to. It used to be very common. Now it's getting less common. And I think it's because people have figured out the trick. So I think it's good to surround yourself with people who are laughing. It just needs to be genuine.
Yeah. Sometimes those laugh tracks were ridiculous because there'd just be roaring, you know, laughter, and it just wasn't that funny of a joke.
Yeah.
Rose in Milwaukee. Hi, Rose. Oh, Rose, you stepped away from your radio, or you're listening on the radio. So I have to go to Julie in Rice Lake then. Hi, Julie.
Good morning.
Morning.
This is wonderful. I'm so glad you're having this program. I wanted to acknowledge and appreciate the life and laughter of David Brenner, who died this past Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
I first was exposed to him as a teenager when he was on the Johnny Carson show back in the day. And I loved the man. I still do. I'm so glad I got to see him live one time. And the write-ups that I've seen about him, New York Times and stuff, his obituary, have said that he did what was called observational humor, and I had never heard that term before, but it was just kind of like the kind of jokes that start with, you ever notice that, you know, whatever. And I also wanted to make sure that people, your listeners, knew that his kind of final closing joke for his death was that he wanted them to put $100 in small bills in his left sock just in case he needed tips where he was going.
Oh. Funny until the end. Yeah.
Yes.
I love that. Yeah, I'd heard that too, and that's right on. I love the idea of the tips in the sock.
Yeah, well, what's the deal with observational humor? Jerry Seinfeld used to do that all the time. You know, did you ever notice when, and what's the deal with that?
I like that line. What's the deal with observational humor?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I mean, I think David Brenner was a pioneer that way. I mean, if it weren't for him, you might not have had Seinfeld and these other kind of comics. And they really highlight how comedians are reflections of their times. In my book, I talk about Lenny Bruce and how he really was a comedian of the 60s. I mean, he just tapped this era of people questioning sexuality and drugs and what is the role of the law and things like that. And I don't know if that humor would work as well today. And I think some comedians really do, they last a very long time. Bill Cosby is one of them, where we, for their whole lives, we laugh. And that's because they're always finding a way to make observations about that particular era and what is getting at people and what we're thinking about. And some people are very skilled at that. And I think these are the ones who make comedy, you know, a lifetime.
So what happened when you tried to apply your research by actually doing stand-up comedy?
Oh, sadly, I failed. I did. I basically had spent, you know, many years just surrounding myself with humor and trying to understand it as best I could. And I figured at the end of that, I needed to at least see what it was like to apply it. I have no interest in being a comedian. I'm happy with my lot in life. But it seemed like a good thing to at least try and see what it was like. So I went and I did an amateur stand-up bit. I think it was like 5 minutes. And, I mean, I bombed. But there were moments when it felt very good, and I can see why people seek it out. It's one of those times when if you're telling a joke and people are connecting with it, it's a very satisfying, living-in-the-moment kind of feel. So I can see the draw in it. I can also see that, I mean, there's a difference between having a sense of humor and immersing yourself in humor and being a professional comedian. And sadly, I think a lot of people don't incorporate humor as much in their lives because they're trying to be a comedian. You know, they're thinking, well, I could never be a comedian. When you don't have to be. You can just understand humor, live it. And so I was disappointed that I didn't do well on the stage, but I felt comfortable enough that my life was richer for the experience.
Yeah, I give you a lot of credit. That would be really hard, I think. Randy in Middleton is with us now. Hi, Randy.
Hi, good morning. Can I throw in my St. Paddy's Day joke?
As long as you follow the rules.
As long as I follow the rules. Well, this is Fat Ollie's Irish joke from the 82nd Precinct novels. These two Irishmen walk out of a bar. Hey, it could happen.
There we go. It's all in good fun, Irishman.
That's always risky with jokes.
Right.
My last week, I came out of a restaurant, and there was a banana peel on the sidewalk. And right away, I sat there looking at it, and I actually looked around to see if there was like a hidden camera or something for researchers. Because that's something I haven't seen for quite a while. And I mentioned that to the group the next day, and one of the women there says, "Oh yeah, a couple of years ago I slipped on a banana peel," and we all just laughed. Nobody ever thought that had actually happened. And next thing we knew, we were having this long, long talk about banana peels and why these actually intrude on our lives.
That's actually funny because really you don't think of people really slipping on banana peels. But what's your reaction to that, Scott?
I love how we've got a history in our culture of jokes. There's certain things that we just connect with jokes. You can't start a sentence with so and so walks in a bar mm-hmm. without just expecting a joke. And you know, you can't look at a banana peel on the ground and just not expect that it's part of a joke. And there's a whole field of humor that plays with that, which is really that first joke that Randy shared about, you know, the Irishman walking in a bar, that there comes a point when you can play with the idea of it, the joke itself, and tease people into thinking that they're about to hear a joke and then take them another way. And so, I mean, there's like elephant jokes are that way, and then chicken crossing the road jokes, you know, why did the chicken cross the road?
To get to the other side, right?
I don't know. He never made it.
Oh, no.
Yeah, just something, you know, stupid like that, where you just expect... You expect a joke, and then you get turned another way. I think that's kind of funny, and it's very meta, I guess.
You know, we have less than a minute, 30 seconds, actually. Is there something we can do today to benefit more from humor in our lives?
Yeah, thank you for asking, because I think that's a really important thing. And the best part is, I don't think you can be taught to be funny, but you can learn humor. And I think humor is just learned by incorporating it in your lives. It doesn't need to be studied. Just finding a way to surround yourself with jokes, laughing people, and thinking a little bit more about humor than we already do. This is enough to see the health and intelligence benefits. So it's good to laugh, and it's good to be a humorous person.
Well, I enjoyed the hour. It was fun. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Scott Weems is author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Thanks to Christy Taylor and Robin Cherry for producing the program. This is the Ideas Network.